This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Quote now at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, October 14th, 1976, the President of the United States is staring down a possible epidemic and trying to balance health and political considerations. And on this day, in front of a host of cameras he'd invited into the Oval Office, President Gerald Ford got vaccinated for the so-called swine flu. Look, the 1976 swine flu story has so many parallels to what we saw in 2020 and continue to see today. For one, 1976 was an election year. You have a sitting president trying to get reelected, but also manage this new health crisis. You have questions about political expediency and health emergencies and rushed vaccine authorizations and vaccine skepticism. Generally speaking, let me sum it up here. Much like 2020's response, the 1976 response can be slotted into the "it was a fiasco" category, but it was a different kind of fiasco, and it illustrates the many ways in which it is possible to turn a pandemic response into a fiasco. What fun. Let's talk about it. Here to discuss, as always, are Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter-Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
Hello, Jody.
Hey there.
And our special guest for this episode is Dr. Jim Hamblin, the author of many, many amazing articles about the coronavirus and also some books, If Our Bodies Could Talk, and the new book is Clean. His current project is the newsletter The Body. It is free. You should go sign up. And I will also disclose that Jim and I are good friends. But Jim, thank you for coming on the show. This is fun.
Thank you for having me.
We'll see if it's fun. Look, I want to get into Ford, and I want to get into sort of him getting the vaccine and the political dimensions of that too. But like, in general, right, this past year and a half has been one in which people look a lot to the past and previous pandemics. Jim, what's your sense of whether the swine flu of 1976 is sort of in the conversation? Why we maybe don't hear about it as much as some of the other historical precedents?
Well, I think we've been focused a lot in the past year and a half on real disasters, worst case scenarios, kind of comparing this to the current pandemic to the 1918 pandemic, and 1976 was just nowhere near what 1918 was. Am I spoiling it?
Yeah, you spoil
a little bit. Okay. I mean, look, it's the dog that didn't bark, right? Like, it's everyone was so terrified that there was going to be a repeat of 1918, and that was the precedent they were looking to, and that there would be a million dead Americans, and it just never happens.
Yeah, so we tend to not, pay attention to the things that didn't come to pass. Although I'm sure if it had been anywhere near what 1918 was, we would definitely be talking about it.
Right. And I mean, I think, as is often the case, like, whether something happens or not, that doesn't really say much about whether, the preparation and the response, those things are still relevant and important and worth looking at. And so I guess we should just back up to, I suppose it's earlier in 1976, there are genuine fears that there is going to be, as Nikki was hinting at, a real outbreak of a new influenza strain. Jim, what is your sense of that story and how legit those fears were?
I tend to err on the side of believing that people are genuinely concerned about new strains of influenza constantly. It's an extremely deadly virus that has the capacity to do tremendous damage, and people have been predicting, decade after decade, that we're going to have a terrible pandemic of influenza, and most of our models for pandemic are based around influenza, and it mutates so readily that it is really difficult to predict. And so at the first sign of a really bad strain, people will raise alarms. And that seems to be, at least to my understanding of it, what happened here after some soldiers at Fort Dix tested positive for some antibodies that seemed to be concerning, seemed to be of a swine flu origin. And that triggered alarm bells that led to an enormous response.
And I think those alarm bells were rooted in something. In addition to just seeing these, I think 155 soldiers had tested positive for the swine flu. But, you know, scientists had made observations that every 10 years or so, the flu seemed to take an evolutionary leap forward and become more virulent. And there was also a 60-year cycle. And the sense that we were due for a pandemic really fed into the belief that this was going to be the one that replicated the horrors of 1918.
I think it's also interesting, too, because the science on all of this is still evolving, and we're still trying to understand how viruses sort of mutate and how the flu, you know, it changes. It's not the same flu every single year. And even when we get our current, you know, flu shots, there's different variations of the flu. But the swine flu is one that was so, I think, terrifying to people because of its ability to be lethal or potent in terms of spreading, and also in terms of, like, when people get it, their ability to be able to recover from it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we didn't have the genomic sequencing back then, obviously, that we have now, that allowed us, you know, within a couple weeks of the first identification of what would become known as COVID-19, the genome was sequenced that would become known as SARS-CoV-2 and spread around the world, and we were able to immediately begin work on vaccination. We knew exactly what we are dealing with. It's never quite so straightforward with influenza, but it certainly wasn't back in 1976.
But that said, and, you know, I think this is one of the places in which there is interesting parallels, or kind of maybe this, you can see this story as a bit of an inversion of what happened in 2020. But, you know, you have this moment, there's 155 cases, and it does seem like the government response is to freak out, you know, in a sort of healthy way, but begin to think, I suppose, exponentially, right? In the way that so many of us were frustrated in spring of 2020, where it felt like, well, the Trump administration is not realizing that they're thinking, oh, these 20 cases will go away, as opposed to realizing, like, we're at the very beginning of this exponential curve. And it seems, and we can get into some of the political dimensions here too, but it does seem at some fundamental level, the Ford administration realizes that they might be at the beginning of a curve that could very easily get out ahead of them.
Yeah, I think that seems to be what they were thinking. And it's a clear contrast to 2020, where the virus was spreading all over the world and it was clearly going to spread very widely, and we were denying it. Here we have a number of cases, and the administration seems to be playing it really safe, trying to, you know, get far out ahead of this, and that's partly due to the nature of the virus. Predicting the flu is sort of like predicting the weather. But clearly there was a different political situation, and people had a different relationship to vaccines in 1976 than they do now.
I think the weather is a really important parallel here, because disaster prevention and preparation always seems like a freak out and always seems like too much until the major disaster hits. So we can talk about the specifics of how the government responds to this, but you do want a government that can ramp up in response to a perceived emergency or a looming emergency and be ready for if that eventuality actually happens. And I think that's why the 2020 parallel becomes kind of interesting here, because you see what happens when a government isn't ready to ramp up that quickly and doesn't take it so seriously. It could have been an over-response to COVID-19, but it turned out to be we had an under-response instead.
And it's interesting, too. We've covered this on an earlier podcast with the polio vaccine and how, like, public trust is so important in getting people to really prepare themselves for taking the vaccine if needed. Right. And when it came to polio, there was hesitation as well. But, you know, I think in 1976, people's relationships with vaccines, there's a little bit more trust, certainly, than there is now. But, like, I also think that investment in getting people to believe what it is that you're pitching is a big part of the process or the road to recovery.
Yeah, absolutely. And in 1976, we were a lot closer to 1918, 1919. Mm-hmm. People, everyone knew someone who'd died of the flu. And that's something that we've clearly seen in response to COVID-19, is the countries that had more recently experienced respiratory viral pandemics, especially SARS, Taiwan, Singapore, Vietnam, these are places with a cultural memory that these are serious diseases that require serious action. And in the U.S., it had been, you know, about 100 years since that. So this was a different situation just in terms of people's capacity to imagine how bad a pandemic can be.
Well, I would also argue just even within this current pandemic, there's a little bit of that dynamic playing out where, I mean, I think New York got hit so hard so early and in such a short period of time that I think it actually, you look at New York's numbers have been pretty good ever since. I think a lot of that might have to do with, there's a lot of factors, but I think a lot of that might have to do with this, what you're getting at, Jim, which is people saw how bad it was, felt it firsthand, and I think have taken precautions and gotten vaccinated as a result, whereas other places where, you know, it got just pretty bad 5 or 6 times over the course of 2 years is not maybe going to sort of learn that lesson or be as visceral. So let's back up a little bit. So Ford gets the vaccine in the fall. Before that, though, I just have a very basic question, which is you look at the timeline of this story. You have the Fort Dix stuff popping up in sort of January, February. In March and April and May, the government starts to get really worried here and starts to convene experts and decide that they want to sort of get a vaccine as quickly as possible. Jim, I mean, my basic sense of how flus work is you freak out about them in like September and October, not in March and April. And so, I mean, if I'm looking at this story, there's part of me that just says like, wait a minute, like the flu season's over and now you're doing this ramping up. Like what do we make of that? Am I way off?
That's a good question. I'm not certain. I mean, it's not impossible for flu to cause an outbreak at any time of the year. There's nothing scientifically linking it to winter months. It's just when it's more common. So it would seem to argue against what they were proposing about this, you know, being a new strain that was arising. But evidently they thought it was possible.
And even given the time of year, there is a real ramp up. Like the World Health Organization is saying, we're going to wait and see. We'll see what happens. But the U.S. government really goes all in. They have emergency legislation for an immunization program that's in place by mid-April. They're working with pharmaceutical companies in order to ramp up production of some kind of vaccine and to protect those companies from any sort of litigation. I think that it is kind of a model for what we would see later in both trying to incentivize the creation of these vaccines and the production of these vaccines. And in order to get them into arms as quickly as possible, the vaccine makers don't want to be held responsible if something goes wrong, given the newness of the vaccine. And the federal government gives it
to them. That's so messed up about this, though.
I know. Like
the vaccine companies are sort of like, the government's like, hey, could you make this faster? And they're like, we haven't really tested this. We don't want to be held liable. Sure, we'll go faster if you can ensure that we won't be sued. And then the government, for a little bit, they're at a stalemate. But then pretty much the government concedes. And it's like, okay, sure, fine. You can't get sued. And, you know, then they start to ramp up, you know, production. But everybody's also trying to CYA a little bit in this process, which is understandable, but at the same time, you know, trying to get people to take action in a meaningful way without having to be so caught up on like fallout, I think is interesting.
Yeah, and that's a precedent that continues today. Mm-hmm. We have to protect vaccine manufacturers from litigation for complex reasons, but this is, to my knowledge, the first known instance of it, and that was done, you would think, in the mindset of like, this is just so clearly an imminent threat. We really have to pull out all the stops.
So in this story now, let's move to, you know, late fall, right? Right before Ford decides to get the vaccine in front of cameras. We'll talk about that decision, but it is largely one that is made because he sees that hesitancy is on the rise and that he really needs to sort of do something. So just before that moment, by September, we have this really interesting dynamic where there's some polling at the time, 93% of the population had heard of swine flu and knew that it could cause a million U.S. deaths. So on some level, the government telling the American people there's something serious going on here is working. But only 52% say at that point that they plan to get the vaccine. So we have this moment just in a matter of months where we've arrived at this place where there's big awareness, but big hesitancy. So I'm curious, you know, Jim, as you read the story, what do you think are, we've talked about some of the building blocks that got us to that point, but what do you think were the strands there that led to that simple disconnect?
I think when you don't have the case counts to establish the threat level, it is going to be very difficult to convince people that they need to get vaccinated. We see this every year with the flu because you have to anticipate it and you have to be saying, you know, there surely, you know, you don't know anyone who's had this yet. You don't know anyone who's died. There've only been a few dozen or 100+ cases that we know about, but you need to trust me here. The threat is real. So to me, 52% sounds pretty much like you're drawing a line based on who, you know, trust in government, yeah. Basically more so than anyone's ability to actually assess where this is going. No one could claim to know more than the scientists who are predicting this strain, but at the same time, they don't have any real world evidence they can show people about cases, about serious outbreaks, about people dying.
And trust in government at this point is not at an all-time high.
1977. Like,
Ford comes into office and he's inherited just this terrible mm-hmm. situation for both government trust and government efficacy, right? So you have, you're coming off of the Vietnam War, you're coming off of Watergate. Everyone knows that the government's been lying to them. You've just had the Church Commission, which has been looking at the, all of the secret experiments that the CIA has been doing and has been lying about, surveilling American protesters and all that. But you also have hyperinflation and this sense that the government can't fix any of the problems that the U.S. is facing. And so here Ford is presented with this opportunity to show that the government can be responsive and that it can be effective and that it can save people's lives. And people are like, I don't know if I want to take the shot that the government is offering.
Right.
Yeah. And it doesn't help that shortly after people have started to get shots, three senior citizens die shortly after getting the flu shot. Now, there's no like proof as to how they died or what happened, but that hysteria around, oh my gosh, I could get this and die, also, you know, plays into the narrative or the fear that people have about, well, this, I'm just rolling the dice when I do this, you know? And so it doesn't help. And I also think it was hard for the media, you know, to sort of get their hands around it, because once this gets out, you can't stop that sort of avalanche yeah. of paranoia and fear from spiraling.
And to be fair, I mean, you know, there were some outbreaks that were happening of like Legionnaire's disease that they didn't know was Legionnaire's disease at the time and thought that it could be related to the vaccine. But, you know, shortly after Ford gets his vaccination, there are these outbreaks of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which leads to paralysis in a lot of people and is connected to the vaccine. So now you're seeing actual health consequences that are tied to the vaccine. And that kills the vaccination program because you don't know anyone who has been harmed by this strain of the flu. But now you're seeing reports of people who have been harmed by the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Guillain-Barré and autoimmune process that can be triggered by lots of different vaccines and by lots of different viruses, and you're more likely to have after you get a case of influenza than after you get an influenza vaccine. And yet the act of, you know, actively taking on a very tiny risk tends to be something that we fear far more than passively possibly encountering a much higher risk. So those cases of Guillain-Barré, yeah, no one wants to feel like they made a decision that led to that. And it can be very difficult to overcome a few highly publicized cases like that.
There's obviously parallels to the anti-vaccine sentiment we're seeing now. But are there actual, like, is this one of the origins of the sort of modern anti-vaccine movement, if you want to call it that, as far as we can tell, Jim?
I think there was a an accretion of instances in the 70s wherein we were coming out of this really romantic vaccination period of polio and smallpox being the most effective, smallpox certainly the most effective thing that medicine and public health have possibly ever done. And we started to think, well, we can actually probably vaccinate, and why not get rid of, you know, all of the viruses, bacteria that cause terrible illnesses in humans. And in the 70s, we started to see, you know, more cases of side effects as we got into dealing with diseases where the risk to benefit was still very clear, but not quite as clear necessarily as eradicating smallpox. And this influenza outbreak made that especially clear, where you had very highly publicized cases of side effects and actually a pretty low risk of actually getting seriously ill from the virus.
And I suppose it's also a reminder, I mean, Ford is a Republican president. He's the one pushing for vaccination here. Some of the skepticism maybe scans on the other side of the political divide. I mean, it's a reminder that this vaccination, and right now, you know, vaccination skepticism is so scanned onto, well, I suppose it's scanned onto a culture war that is scanned onto a political divide. But, you know, basically it feels like it is so cleaved along political lines. Whereas in the past, it has been much more politically agnostic.
Yeah, it was not a partisan issue at the time, and there's nothing innately partisan about it. You can just as well see or imagine a world where Republicans who might stock up on guns are stocking up on vaccine boosters. There's nothing innately ideological to this. That is a pure, you know, an invention of our current political scene.
Well, then, not to make this all about 2020, but wait, are you sort of implying there or hinting there that maybe there was this moment in which Trump could have owned the vaccine and MAGA could mean I'm all about the vaccine?
There's no reason that it couldn't have gone that direction. Yeah.
And would it have taken basically what Ford did, which was invite a bunch of cameras, roll up your sleeve, and get vaccinated on national TV?
Yeah, I mean, I think it needed to start from the very beginning of Trump taking seriously the threat and not downplaying it, so that people understood, you know, what they were dealing with. And then secondarily, once you had a vaccine, you know, making clear the benefit of it, because it is always a risk benefit calculation. And in Trump's case, he downplayed the risk and then failed to play up the benefit of vaccines.
To me, it does make me think a lot, though, about, like, you know, how these political lines get drawn or sides get chosen as to who's pro-vaccine and who's anti-vaccine and how that plays out. It's not as predictable, I guess, as we thought it might be, but it's just wild. It's wild.
Well, and to think about how important trust is to all of these things, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about when we talk in some ways about this partisan divide, is that, you know, Trump voters trust Donald Trump and weren't given a message, as Jim was saying, about both the seriousness and the efficacy of this vaccine, particularly after Donald Trump lost the election.
And that's another parallel to this story, right? Because you read some of the reporting at the time, and there's, I think, legit reporting and skepticism saying, look, Ford is this president who's up for re-election in the fall. We have this outbreak that wasn't, and he's still rushing headlong into this vaccination push, and now he's trying to pull off this stunt where he rolls up his sleeve in the White House and gets a shot. You know, I think that those concerns were, or that skepticism, I think, is valid. You know, I would argue, like, I'd rather have someone acting politically expedient to tell people to get it, vaccines, than to not, you know. And so, like, if someone's going to be cynically political, do it at least in erring on the side of health and caution.
Yeah. Although each time you raise, you know, a false alarm, you do sacrifice some longer term credibility. So in public health, we try to err on the side of caution. But at the same time, I think that is a reason that people were hesitant to really call out what was clearly happening in late February of 2020, even mid-February of 2020, because you realize there is there is harm in declaring a false alarm and in playing up a threat that, that doesn't come to pass.
The boy who cried swine flu.
So as we wrap up, Jim, I just have a sort of bigger question for you about kind of this moment in public health, because like, you know, you obviously over the last year and a half have done so much really great work on COVID, but you are a health journalist and you try and write about the sort of health writ large. And I think the new newsletter does a good job of that. And I noticed last week you finally wrote about something that wasn't COVID. But I'm curious, kind of like, you know, to that end, like, is this a moment where COVID is such a big story, it has gotten people thinking about health in general, and so it's a good time to be exploring those ideas? Or is like COVID so overwhelming that there's no room to talk about any of the other important health things that, that truly matter long term?
I think in this moment, people are very hungry to turn their attention to something else, to other matters of health, which we may have been neglecting, like new research in, you know, nutrition or exercise or any of the myriad diseases that are not COVID-19. So I think there's a big backlog there, and hopefully people will have an appetite to read about the other things soon.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of the episode. Jim Hamblin, thanks to you.
Thank you for having me.
The newsletter is free. It is called The Body. Go check it out once a week, right?
Yes.
Great. There you go. And Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thank you. Thanks to you. God, I keep fucking these up. It's only been like a year and a half. Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
No one knows exactly how serious this threat could be. Nevertheless, we cannot afford to take a chance with the health of our nation.
Radiotopia.